This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Welcome to Eco Radio KC. My name is Teresa Wilkie. On today's program, Zach Pastora will be interviewed by host Richard Mabian, and they'll discuss Kansas environmental issues facing the wrap-up of the Kansas legislature. First, the environmental news for the week of 9/17. The New York Times reports that Typhoon Mangkhut battered Hong Kong and Macau on Sunday with 100-mile-per-hour wind gusts, drenching rains, and 11-foot surges of seawater that inundated the first urban area of Asia to face the wrath of this year's mightiest storm. Mangkhut left a swath of damaged buildings and scores of injuries. This type of climate event is happening with increased frequency all over the world. On the other side of the world, we were preoccupied with the destructive power of Hurricane Florence as it drenched the Carolinas. A climate conference in California this week tried something different. The meeting, organized by the state's governor, Jerry Brown, had far fewer national leaders present. Instead, an array of governors, mayors, and business executives from around the globe met to promote their successes in cutting greenhouse gas emissions locally and to encourage one another to do more. A key premise of the conference was that if it's a handful of leading-edge states, cities, and businesses can demonstrate that it's feasible and even lucrative to go green, they might inspire others to follow suit. Again, a key premise of the conference was that if a handful of leading-edge states, cities, and businesses can demonstrate that it's feasible and even lucrative to go green, they might inspire others to follow suit. There was no shortage of announcements at the meeting. Cities like Tokyo, Rotterdam, and West Hollywood signed joint pledges to buy only zero-emissions buses after 2025. Companies like Walmart and Unilever rolled out new programs to limit deforestation in their large supply chains. Dozens of philanthropic groups committed $4 billion over the next 5 years to fight climate change. But it will take time to tell whether these local actions can scale up quickly enough to make a significant dent in global emissions. And scientists are warning that time is short if we want to avoid the worst effects of climate change. On Thursday, a group of researchers released a roadmap for what it would take to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius, the internationally agreed-upon goal. The American politicians at the conference, who typically came from liberal cities and blue states like New York and Washington, had immediate concerns. Trying to persuade the rest of the world that the United States hasn't completely abandoned the fight, despite the fact that President Trump has vowed to withdraw from the Paris Agreement on climate change. There were even a few substantive policy announcements. California, New York, Maryland, and Connecticut said they would craft new regulations to curtail hydrofluorocarbons, the highly potent greenhouse gases used in air conditioners and refrigerators. In 2016, nations agreed on a treaty to phase out these gases, but Mr. Trump has not submitted the pact for ratification or written federal regulations. Local leaders in the United States who have promised to uphold the Paris Climate Agreement still face an uphill battle. Their coalition, which now consists of 16 states, Puerto Rico, hundreds of cities, and nearly 2,000 businesses, have vowed to press ahead with climate action and ensure that the United States meets former President Barack Obama's Paris pledge to cut greenhouse gas emissions 26% to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025. A new report commissioned by the group, however, found the emissions are on track to fall only about 17% over that span. So we need to continue our work. Associated Press reported that Iowa environmental officials credit quick action by a farmer for preventing environmental damage from a manure spill. An officer from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources investigated a manure spill 3 miles southwest of Scranton, Iowa. Liquid manure spilled from a tanker truck when it overturned Saturday morning. About 2,000 gallons of manure flowed into a ditch. The ditch was quickly dammed on either side of the spill, and a contractor was called to pump the liquid manure onto a nearby farm field. Quick action helped contain the spill and avoided letting it reach any river or stream.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and thank you for tuning in. And it seems like it's been for ages since I've been here. Boy, I was sitting here trying to write down on the sheet what I've been doing for the last couple of months, and it's unbelievable. And it's really ironic because I really want to tell you about it, and I can't. I've never really been in a position to do that. But if I start talking to you about it now, I'm afraid that it's going to tip the hand of some people who could do everything they could to prevent what we're trying to do from happening. But as soon as we can get to a point where we can get what we're wanting to do in a position for it to happen, I'm going to open up the floodgates, because my concern has to do with the fact that if we don't educate the low-income community on how to develop itself economically, that we will continue to have the problems that we have existing within our low-income communities. Regardless of what you see, from the shootings to the burglaries to the common assaults, most of it has to do from a foundation of a lack of opportunities. And I know that's hard to say. And I know that people are going to say, I didn't give a person the right to pull out his gun and shoot somebody. I agree. But I'm not talking about you, and I'm not talking about me. But I'm talking about the people who are finding themselves in those positions. It's going to become our responsibility to provide them with those kind of opportunities, just like we're providing our future generations with the exposure to science and technology, finding ways to circumvent the lack of opportunity that's going on in our low-income communities is our responsibility too, whether we know it or not, or whether we want to accept it or not. It is our responsibility. Everyone's biting at the bit trying to figure out how to do it. But I want you to know yours truly is 100% involved in it. And my concern is the salvation of our inner cities. I recently attended a conference. I've been to so many conferences, boy. I'm in and out of town. But I attended one that was in Pittsburgh, and it was dealing with the equity and sustainability. You know, it's time. We can no longer continue to have this them and they, and those with and the haves and have nots. And we're going to have it, but we got to figure out some way for the have nots to be able to also find some sustainability. And I know it might be just playing on words, but believe me, that's our responsibility. And I think that it's out here. You can see it when you go certain places. Some of our third world countries have been able to find ways of being able to create circumstances, permaculture and all these other things that's going on. But, you know, our inner cities are still clueless, and I'm talking about from your elite to the leadership on environmental circumstances. And I'm not just talking about running around trying to shut down places and close doors and using restrictions. I'm talking about people in the food that they eat that's still missing. I mean, no one's saying anything about it. I mean, and it's ridiculous. We had a show on here a year or so ago from a couple of authors who wrote about the fact that they found that pollution had something to do with the violence that we're seeing in our inner cities. And that goes by like it's no big thing at all. People are still running around trying to figure out how they can get Trump out of office. Our people are dying out here in the streets. You know, that case down there in Texas, and I know this is not normally what you hear me talking about, but yes, it is. I've been doing it ever since I've been on here. But that case down there in Texas of that police officer going into the wrong apartment and shooting the guy. Everybody always talks about the negative as far as what she did and how horrible that was and all of that. But for me, because of the work I'm doing, it's got me saying to people, if in fact what she said happened, and it was a truly tragic accident, I want us to focus in on the fact that we have people living in America today that are walking around just that scared. She came in off of a shift as a police officer out in the streets. Do you know what a police officer goes through out in the streets? You know how alert and tense and adrenaline flowing and stuff that has to be going on with them nowadays? See, that's that mental health issue thing we're talking about. And that's a tragedy. That's a tragedy to understand that we're living in that kind of environment. And again, I come back and say, we keep waiting for somebody else to make this problem an issue. And it needs to be us that it makes this problem an issue. We need to find ways to start coming to the table with each other, because it's our world, it's our planet. And this is our country. And so we cannot allow politicians to dictate how we think and act. And right now, that's all we got. And if you leave it up to what we see going on in the media, we'll be fighting in the streets in a minute. I can't even begin to figure out what would cause a person to think that they out in the middle of a crowd, they can take out a gun and shoot at people. That is the most asinine thing I ever heard in my life. And get away. God, man. So I had to throw that in. I'll get off my soapbox now. Like I said, I hadn't been here in a little while. Mike is looking at me crazy going, hey, what are you talking about, Richard? But anyhow, I'm glad to be back. I got my guy with me here today, Zach. Just want to say hello.
Hey, to Richard. Hey, everyone. Zach Pastore from the Kansas Sierra Club joining you today.
Yes.
Back. I think this is my seventh.
Is it?
Time with y'all.
Is it?
On this program.
You permanent. You
always an honor. Thank you.
You know, Saturday we had the 100-year anniversary of the Kansas City, Kansas NAACP, and Zach, of course, came over and was my bodyguard. He came over and was the... He's going to do a story for the Sierra Club, and I thought that was real special for him to be there. What did you think about it?
Oh, that was such a fine event, really special, amazing. 100 years going, all the work that our local NAACP chapter has done, just amazing. Rich history there with the organization across the country, and a lot of good work done in our own city. So thanks for helping lead the charge there, Richard.
Yeah, I guess you could say they even got Richard to sing. I want y'all to know that, man. The guy that was supposed to didn't make it, so I had to end up leading Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is the Black Negro National Anthem, for those of you who didn't know it. Let's talk about some health here. Let's talk about some environment. Come on.
Well, before we begin, I just want to say that, thinking about everybody out in Carolinas with the hurricane, I just know that that's I can't imagine. You know, I was in D.C. Last week, and all I could see on the news was the hurricane. And, man, we think tornadoes are bad. Right. Talk about them being way bigger and with rain and floodwaters. It's just a tragedy. And to connect that with the environment, what we've seen is an increasing amount of dangerous and costly natural disasters. We start messing with the climate, we get some weird things happening with warm and cold air currents coming together and creating some pretty powerful things.
My motivation for getting involved in the environmental movement was Katrina.
Right.
And the reason for exactly what you're talking about, but from a different perspective, always looking at it from a different perspective, I cannot understand how you could, this day and age, be in a position that people could be trapped into that with no leadership coming out of the community to deal with the problem before they get trapped. In Katrina, they ended up in the Astrodome, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just, I was going, what if that happened? I was on Quindaro then. I was going, what if that happened here? And I was talking to a store owner over there, and I said, you could have a tornado that would cut us off from the rest of the city, and people would be without. We have to be able to start figuring out ways to be able to survive during those kind of circumstances instead of when they happen. And that's what got me in the environmental movement. And we're making progress here as far as being able to unite ourselves or unite the community. I haven't got people on board yet, but the purpose is to unite the community to deal with circumstances that happen when you have some kind of breakdown like that.
Right. Oh, I mean, so many people are dealing without electricity, without being able to go to their shelter, their home, and
And you got all kind of toxic stuff out there floating around. That's what this program we're trying to put together with El Centro and EOF and Donnelly College to teach marketable skills when it comes to environmental circumstances, because it has a hazmat component to it. To be able to take the class, of course, you have to have 40 hours of hazmat training and you get a certificate. So when those kind of conditions occur, you got people on the ground right there in your face that have the training to get in there to get involved to help people out of the situation.
Perfect.
That's
good. Yep. You got to do it on the front end with helping reduce, create technology,
right.
Get community programs to help prevent situations to happen, but then also on the response,
side too.
Yep.
Okay, now you hear you was in D.C., buddy.
Yes.
You didn't see my buddy up there. You see my friend up there running around, Mr. Trump, did you?
I did, unfortunately. I was going to tell him you said hi.
I
got to see a few of our representatives, which was nice.
That's good.
So I'll talk a little bit about that. Yeah. But just so everybody realizes, I've been state lobbying for 7 years now for the Kansas Sierra Club. This is the first time I went up with a group of Kansas farmers with the Farmers Union.
I think that's
and
good.
Lobby the federal delegates. We're talking about our local congressman here, Congressman Yoder.
Right.
We got our two senators, Roberts and Moran, and as well as the rest of the Kansas delegation. So, yeah, it was quite the deal. I didn't know how well I was going to fare, because it's Topeka at the State House is a lot different than D.C.
Right.
And so your access to get to the representatives is a little tougher.
Well, were they there?
We only had one of the six that actually met with our eight farmers that traveled all the way from Kansas to D.C. To speak with those folks. We got to speak with the staff, which was all fine and well.
Right.
But it pays to know who your congressmen, congresswomen are. Up the state, capital, U.S. Capitol, because I caught two just passing by them in the hallways, and so it's good little skill, citizen lobbying for those keeping track. Is just go up to your representative, tell them that you're from Kansas and that you appreciate their public service, and the more that they do on the farm bill, the better. I even helped fix Congressman Yoder's little collar on his suit was messed up. So I
wish you'd mention my name. so tell us about the farm bill. What's happening with that?
Well, we can go in a few more specifics after the break, but we were basically up there to talk about what the farm bill means to Kansas. We had eight different farmers from across the state, one from western Kansas, a bigger farmer with thousands of acres with more of those traditional commodity crops, wheat and corn and cows. We had a urban farmer out of Wichita, been celebrated her 50th anniversary of her farm. African American farmer, which you don't see very many of Kansas, so that was pretty special. And something I'd talk about is they got a mobile market.
Okay.
A mobile
from that
market.
Same farm?
Yeah, same farm. They figured that a lot of folks who desperately need food don't always have the transportation to access that food. So we can talk a little bit more about that after the break.
I like that whole concept. So, yeah, how many of them went with you?
We had a total 8 cases.
How long were you up there?
We were up there for about 3 days total.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So did they have a meeting? Who put it on?
It was the National Farmers Union. So we had the Kansas Farmers Union, which is the second largest farm group.
Right.
And then with the national umbrella. So we went up there. There were 350 farmers from across the country there at one time. To lobby our legislature.
That was
a sight. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take this break. We'll be right back. First of all, I'm going to give you the number here at the studio so that if any of you would like to join in our conversation, feel free to do so. That's 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
21 young plaintiffs are alleging that the United States knew since the 50s that a climate calamity would be the result of a carbon energy economy, yet did little to stop it, in deference to industry. Hear the story on Wings, Saturday at 2:30.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and if you want to join this conversation, come on and give us a call. Don't wait until the last minute to do so. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
Hi, all. This is Leslie Pourries, Vice President of the Board here at KKFI. I want you to consider becoming an active member here at the station. Active members are the people who volunteer an average of 4 hours a month. And when you become an active member, you have a vote on all the major decisions of the station. Community radio at its best. We only fulfill our mission of serving the community when it reflects your voice. Come on down and get involved.
Saving water while traveling. On today's Current Cast. Hotels and motels use a lot of water, but it's not all within their control. According to Tara O'Hare of the EPA's WaterSense program, guests are responsible for about 30% of a hotel's total water use. To conserve, she suggests travelers take the same steps they do at home. Keep their showers short and turn off the faucet while brushing their teeth.
Guests can also keep their thermostat at a moderate temperature to reduce the energy and water needed to heat and cool their rooms.
Ask at the front desk if the hotel has a towel and linen reuse program. Participating reduces the water used for laundry and gives a whole new meaning to the term traveling light. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
All right, I'm back again. Boy, you're getting a full dose of me tonight, boy. I want to get that number out one more time just in case you want to call in. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. Okay, Zach, tell me, let's talk about it.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if everybody knows about the Farm Bill. When we talk about the Farm Bill, especially for those folks that didn't grow up on a farm, even those that did not always know about what the Farm Bill program is. Basically, it controls, it's the chief financial program that funds and prescribes the policies for everything related to agriculture, from crop insurance to commodity programs. Commodities are wheat, corn, rice, cotton, and beans, those big staple crops. It also has to deal with urban agriculture, local food systems, and the like. And then a major component that often doesn't get thought about is food assistance.
Okay.
SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is your food stamps.
Right.
And actually, that's the biggest piece financially of the Farm Bill, composes 80% of the spending of the Farm Bill. And the idea was, and this goes a long while back, is that in order to get support for our rural policies and programs from the urbanites, the urban legislatures, and in order for get the food assistance help that the urban legislators wanted for the inner cities, they combined the two, the food and farm, into one farm bill.
One farm bill. See, we'll go ahead. I'm not.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. But
so, what we have right now for those that don't know is we have a House version of the Farm Bill that got passed, and the Senate version of the Farm Bill got passed, and every 5 years we pass
pass a farm bill and it's good for 5 years, then we have to renew it. It's good because it allows for certain changes along the way, but also gives farmers a predictability, a certainty with the programs that they offer. Okay, so we have a House version passed that passed only by 2 votes. Mm. It was on party lines. You had all Republicans voting, all Republicans that voted in favor, with a few Republicans that voted against it. But it was, the ones that voted in favor were all Republicans, and then all the Democrats voted against it on the House version. Okay, the Senate version, led by our own Kansas Senator Pat Roberts, passed 86-11.
Wow.
A bipartisan support.
Yeah,
both Democrats and Republicans. And actually, that's the biggest bipartisan supported bill that got passed in history.
Wow.
That many votes. And they probably would have had a few more votes had a couple more senators been present for the vote. So you can see there's quite a bit of a difference between the House version and the Senate version just on the votes alone and who's voting for them. But what you have is the House specifically wants to cut programs related to the SNAP, to the food assistance.
Okay.
They want to shrink the amount of funding. They want to increase the amount of work requirements for folks that get food assistance, kind of this kind of shrinking government mentality, getting people off of a welfare onto work. But and when you start digging in the finer details, a lot of people that receive this food assistance are working.
Yeah, but I'm gonna have this question. How much of that funding goes for administrative purposes?
It's a small amount.
Small amount.
Very small amount. Maybe 5%, okay. I think. Maybe just a little bit more, but over 90% of that money goes directly to the people,
okay.
Which
that's
is what
good.
You want.
Yeah.
And just to bring it back home here, we have about 250,000 Kansans that depend on this food assistance every month.
Okay.
That's quite a few.
That's right.
Across the country, 1 in 8 Americans depend on the food assistance. Just in our local area, the District 3 here includes Kansas City and Johnson County, a little bit south of us, about 20,000 households. So if you think about it in terms of households, about 20,000 households depend on this food assistance.
Yeah.
So,
well, when you have, we have almost 100%, 90-some percent a lunch program, free lunch program in school, that shows you the caliber, the status of your low income community as far as income is concerned. So we were high in Wyandotte County, so I understand
right. But this is a piece of the difference between the House version and the Senate version.
Right.
The Senate version keeps it pretty much the same as the last farm bill cycle. We much prefer the Senate version of the farm bill in a lot of ways. The farmers do, but without getting into that. There's different programs that also the farmers are concerned with, conservation programs. Those programs that allow for plant and cover crops, different spray nozzles on your sprayers, so you're not getting pesticide that drifts in the air onto your neighbors or downwind, and somebody could be breathing that, gets it right on the plant. Same with irrigation. Make sure that the water gets on the crops and not elsewhere. A lot of different innovations and technology, along with land programs, which plant buffer strips and plant and cover crops and some of those things. All those help keep the water and soil from eroding downstream.
Now, on those sprayers, you know, I don't know why I've become a critic here, but so the farmers have to buy some kind of nozzle.
Right. And depending on the nozzle, you want certain types of nozzles for certain types of spray,
right.
When it comes to pesticides. You know, that way you can, you know, focus it in on the certain plants of your crops.
Well, the reason I was asking, a lot of bills get passed where you have favoritism going from the people who submit the bids with the company that's making the products. And so I said, as soon as you said that, the first thing that came to my mind, that means farmers are going to have to go out and buy these nozzles. I like what they're doing. They're keeping it from getting on the other person's property and going downwind.
Right.
But I'm really concerned about what kind of subsidy they're going to give the farmers to be able to go out and buy those, or, because it's all about business. You know that we live in that kind of world.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and here we are, some Kansas farmers, primarily independent family farmers.
Right.
We have to compete a host of special interests within the farm bill arena. You know, that include chemical companies that make pesticides, including agribusinesses that have, you know,
tons of money.
Yeah, equipment.
Stock holders.
Oh, yes. Old. Oh, yeah. And that's one of the issues that also was in one of the versions of the Farm Bill. The Senate version was have a payment limits so that the money that comes out of the Farm Bill gets focused to those people that really need it, not these large farms. And in fact, Kansas is home to a lot of those large farms.
Yeah.
That get, and so we want those payments going directly to the farmers on the land, not Wall Street investors sorts
right.
of things.
Right.
So, that makes sense, from our standpoint. There's a number of things. It was just quite the experience.
What about water?
Water. There are some water programs that get involved in the Farm Bill. Okay, there's a number of titles of the Farm Bill. Working on water is one of those. You got the Environmental Quality Incentive Program, EQIP, which provides dollars to farmers that want to help control for water quality and water quantity on their farm. Those are more specific programs. You have to write up a grant to submit it to your local NRCS office or your local FSA, Farm Service Agency, and say that I'm going to provide some buffer strips, plant some buffer strips, so that way when I irrigate, that water doesn't go directly off my land and into the stream, carrying sediment and all that with it. It goes through that buffer strip, slows it down, keeps that water on the field.
Okay.
The water is a big portion of that. You also got a rural development in that as well.
Okay.
So it's pretty important.
Animals,
animal inspection, safety, food safety, all that is in with this. If it has anything to do with agriculture or food, it's probably has some part of it in
I'm
the farm bill.
I'm thinking about Craig Vollen and his pet peeves on those CAFOs. And,
right.
So they have things that address that. Because it gets pretty technical in there. Like you can have so much.
Maybe you can explain what CAFO.
Concentrated animal feeding operation. He's talking about these large farms, animal farms.
Right.
It could be improved, but there is funding and programs in place to help address that so they can get the right type of lagoon systems in place. And then also technical assistance and research. That is the title of the Farm Bill that gets a lot of money that goes through our universities and extension programs specifically for farms and farmers.
Okay. So, all right. Interesting.
Yep. So it was quite the experience. We'll see what happens with it. I think talking with farmers and non-farmers across Kansas, the more we can do to help reduce runoff and soil loss, improve water quality, improve access to healthy and local foods, all those things are support research. All those things are important, and people recognize it in our state. We're a top 10 ag state. There is a lot of room for growth in agriculture, especially and growing foods locally, fruits and vegetables, healthy foods.
Right.
A lot. Let me just give you a picture here. A big point of discussion in the lobbying was this trade issue with the tariffs that the president's putting on, whether we're going to be able to sell China our soybeans, whether farmers are going to make it. And really, farmers are feeling the struggle. We had a farm crisis in the 80s. We're on the point of having another farm crisis where farmers plant crops but don't get the money back for the crops that they plant. And so then they're struggling to make ends meet on their own farm, and then it affects their mental health. We've been having mental health issues in the farming community. Putting food on the table, they already absorb a large risk in farming today, financial, and planting those crops in the ground and hoping that they're going to come up and hope that the weather,
fares
well.
We have drought going on.
So all that, adds into the equation here. And if they can't get the prices that they need in order to make a living for the crops that they plant, then that becomes a pretty dire for those folks. And we heard a lot about that up in Washington.
I'm really glad that's why I wanted you to come on, because we don't get that much information here on the east side of the state about what's going on with in the state as far as farming is concerned. It's an agriculture state, and I think it's good for people to understand that those people out there are being asked to do their fair share of making things work too. And when I found out that they were voluntarily dealing with water days, certain days they water, certain days they don't, that's showing that they're giving it some concern. I wish we would understand the concern that we need to be given in the inner cities or in the urban community. Because when you say inner city, people zero in on particular color. But I'm just saying, as far as in your dense population,
urban, suburban,
that with things that we need to really be. I still don't see recycling as being what I think it should be,
right?
West of 630, east of 635. So we need to be able to really concentrate more on that. I mean, I can't believe that Quick Trip doesn't have recycling. You know, as much business as they do with all the cups and plastic and stuff that they have, that no one has said anything to them as far as encouraging them to go into some kind of recycling program. And so we got that across the board. And it would be good if these urban folks would see how much the rural people are doing to contribute to the salvation of this planet. I think it can make a big difference.
Right. Yeah. And there could be, obviously, there could be improvement in the rural communities and farmers. I mean, you say farmers are great stewards of our land, but a lot of the pollution we're seeing in waters is coming from non-point sources, fertilizers, pesticides coming off the land. Anyway.
I'm going to throw out the number again. That's 816-931-5534. Come on and join us. 816-931-5534. What else you got going on,
buddy?
Well,
I just want to say the last point on the farm bill and the trade issue, very contentious right now. But I know we have...
When you say that, it's contentious in how? I mean, it's one thing to say that, but what do you see going on?
In the farming community, you know, if China, in the exports, there's $120 billion worth of exports that we do in agriculture. That's a lot. And that's a lot of people. No, that's countrywide.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so if our main buyers like Mexico, China, Canada, Europe, you know, if they're not taking a lot of those exports, for one reason or another, because we're putting tariffs on their goods and they're saying, okay, well, we see your tariffs and we want to raise it. You know, we want to match your tariffs. And we say, well, we're going to raise your tariffs. You know, this tariffs game that's going on. Nobody's feeling it more in my mind than our manufacturing industry and our agricultural industry. When it comes to exports to either China or Mexico. So that's what's happening in kind of global politics. But one thing I want to remind people is on the imports, we import a lot of goods as well, quite a bit. It's not as much as we export, but billions of dollars of imports. 40% of those imports when it comes to agriculture are horticulture products. Those are our fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
So if we're importing 40% of our fruits and vegetables and flowers, you know, that's a way we can almost help out that trade scenario by essentially trading with ourselves.
Okay.
Saying we're not going to buy from other countries much, but we're going to produce those goods for ourselves, save us some money, and give people some jobs and some healthy foods.
Do we have the climate for being able to do that on a consistent basis?
So, you know, we're not going to be able to grow bananas and tropical fruits, sugar, and some of those things.
Right.
We can do some of that, but not all of it. I'm talking about fruits and vegetables that maybe we buy Mexican tomatoes when we could be growing tomatoes here in Kansas.
Yes. Yeah.
So anyway, that's just something to keep in mind. in Kansas specifically, we import 96% of our fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Let that sink in. 96% of our fruits and vegetables we buy from other states.
Right.
We're top 10 agriculture producer in a lot of different crops. But for crops that we can actually put on our plate and in our stomachs, sometimes that's hard to come by.
So, I agree with you.
Urban agriculture is a big piece of that. They can provide. They got the people and the labor right there. They can provide a lot of that opportunity for fruits and vegetables.
Well, it makes me think of Joe Jennings, you know, because of his age, he turned his farm into more of an orchard. And so now he's doing like 18 to 20,000 pounds of fruits.
Wow.
With peaches and mostly peaches, but he's doing it and he's giving it to harvester because he can't do anything with it. So they come out and glean his farm using the kids out of these various programs. And he's really excited about being able to do that. So it shows that it can grow here.
Yep.
All right, we're going to take another break. That number again is 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534.
Thanks for tuning in to KKFI. The future is here. Simply tell your smart speaker, play KKFI. If you haven't already, give it a shot. KKFI can be wherever you are.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. Kristen Rigney was ready for rain on her wedding day.
I had planned and I ordered cute umbrellas for the bridesmaids for our photos.
But she did not anticipate the flash flood that struck Ellicott City, Maryland, just before her ceremony was set to begin last May.
Our coordinator throws open the door and goes, "We're evacuating! Get everything! Get out! We gotta get out!"
For hours, Rigney and her guests hurried from place to place to stay safe. First, they went upstairs, where she and her groom managed to exchange vows in a Mexican restaurant. Then, some guests evacuated to a liquor store. Others ran up a hillside and huddled on porches.
I was kind of just in survival mode.
As the climate warms, rainstorms are intensifying. In Maryland and the Northeast, the amount of rain that falls during the most extreme storms has increased by more than 70% since the 1950s. The effects can be devastating. In Ellicott City that day, the flood destroyed homes and businesses. One man was killed.
We lost a lot of food and cars, and people lost their fancy clothes, but the people who actually live in Ellicott City lost so much more.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian, and I'm here with Zach, and we're doing our routine of bringing everybody up to date on what's going on legislatively in the state of Kansas. Okay, Zach, what else you got there, buddy?
Well, so we're coming up to a pretty important time here pretty soon.
What's that?
Okay, well, this is a time to get out the vote.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we need as many people to register to vote by October 16th. I'm looking at my watch here. That's less than a month away.
That's right.
So the countdown has begun.
Well, you know, and there's plenty of organizations that's out here working on this. So I know there's not a person that's hearing my voice that hasn't been confronted by someone asking them, are they registered, or make sure you're going out to vote. So, you know, do what you can. I haven't been to a session where that hasn't been an issue, even to include the NAACP meeting. And that is just constantly someone's bringing it up, and that's a good thing.
Right.
It's a good
thing. Oh, it's absolutely. It's a huge part. You know, I think about all those people that fought for the right to vote, laid their lives on the line, gave up, a lot to do that for us. So it's in my mind, it's a disrespect to those people,
right,
to not exercise that privilege that we have today. It really means a lot. You know, I'll specifically make a plea to young people.
Yes.
Young people, if you're under 35 out there, the statistics show it's going to be between 30 and 40% of us that go out there and vote. But you know, our population, millennial population, is actually outgrowed the baby boomers.
Right.
At this time, we have more people, more numbers than any generation at this point right now.
Do you?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so we could tilt the power scales into our favor if we exercise that civic duty to go out and vote. I know it's tough because for young people, you know, that haven't been exposed to this, haven't gone and actually done the vote before, it kind of feels like doing your taxes for the first time. Okay. It's intimidating. There's a language. You know, I don't know anything about those candidates. It can feel like, you know, does my vote really matter? All that stuff. I'm saying if you're not out there research and doing your homework on that, finding out from your friends, your community, finding within yourself what issues matter and who that representative is going to be, then you're not doing yourself justice. You're basically, if you want to be at the table, you need to step in and be a player in the game. Otherwise, you're getting played.
That's right.
If we want to say, well, we don't say the government represents us, then you can step into that conversation by being, by voting one, but by engaging in the policy debate, whether that's going up to Topeka, getting part of an organization as a member and supporting the cause, a number of different ways. It going to a town hall or a debate. You'll be seeing some debates coming up. Just being paying attention there. And really, you know, there's probably a lot of us that aren't so worried about this because we are going to planning on voting.
Right.
But you probably know somebody or some buddies that may not have voted before. Pull them into this. Help them stay accountable and do your best to try to get all your friends and family to go out there and exercise your civic duty. It really is patriotic at its core. And in my mind, it's the right thing to do for us to have a better government.
What's that final day for registration again?
October 16th.
You heard that, folks. October 16th.
October 16th. So. And you can get an advance ballot. You know, I encourage folks to sign up for advance ballot. That way, if something comes up on that that Tuesday, voting November 6th, something unforeseen, you can at least cast your vote ahead of time by mail.
Yep.
And then that way you get the list, the ballot, you can review the candidates on that as opposed to having to make that kind of crunch time decision in the polls. Avoid those lines,
right?
And all that. So anyway, that's my plea. You know, we have some representatives, some strong races, high stakes. All of the Kansas House, so all those local representatives at the state level are up for election. So pay attention to that. We have a governor's race, a treasurer's race, insurance. There's a lot going on there as far as state politics. And I would say those state issues sometimes hit us closer to home than federal and the president.
All politics is local, and we need to understand that.
Yeah, but we also have Congress.
Yes.
Congressional House seats up, so those are important too. In fact, in our Kansas City, we have a pretty toss-up race.
Yeah.
Between Kevin Yoder, the incumbent, and Sharice Davids.
Yes.
So we'll be keeping our eyes on that. So please, research the issues. Think about the environment, obviously. I'd say those who care about the environment, research our folks' stances, whether at the local, the state level, or at the Congress level, and see how they fare on positions. So.
Well, I said, did I hear you putting yourself in with the millennials? Did you?
Yes.
I heard you say, we millennials.
Yeah, well, supposedly I'm in the group.
Yeah.
Folks born after 1982 up until 18 years old are considered the millennials. Okay.
So I'm
30. I'm in there. It really, you know.
Well,
it's just amazing.
That,
30% to 40%, 40% on a presidential year of voting. 4 out of 10, last time I checked, that's not getting you a good grade in school.
No.
That's a failing grade.
It's a failing grade.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is right. It is our inalienable right to be able to vote. So I appreciate you doing that. And I'm glad that we had a chance to bring it from an environmental perspective, because it'll be coming from all different directions.
Right.
But it's good to bring it from the environmental perspective, because there's so much that we need to make sure we're getting done. And the best way to do that is through the vote and through the candidates that we have running for these offices. I appreciate that. Zach, we're down to just a couple of minutes to go. I'll let you kind of wrap it up with anything that you want to kind of give any. Oh, the issue about the pesticide. Do you have time to mention that?
The House version, the controversial bill, the House version would strike a piece of the pesticide. So
House version of
the Farm Bill. Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Of the Farm Bill would strike a piece that would kind of reduce the effectiveness of checking with other agencies on pesticides.
So. Okay. All right, gang. Well, this has been a good
thanks
one.
For having me,
y'all,
Richard. Appreciate it. Always
it,
a pleasure,
you know,
Mike.
I do, man. You're
good program
you're
here.
You're a buddy for us. Okay, Mike, you got it there, buddy.
Now the calendar of events for the week of 9/17. September 22nd, Shoal Creek Stream Party helps people learn about streams at Happy Rock Park, 7600 Northeast Antioch Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Lunch will be served. Information is available at Vicki, V-I-C-K-I, at healthyriverspartnership.org or call 816-812-5166. September 18th, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., take a hike through the woods to harvest Missouri wild edibles and then learn how to prepare them at the Burr Oak Woods Conservation Nature Center. This free two-hour workshop includes an optional hike and a class. The class is designed for participants age 18 and older and will be held from 9 to 11 at the Nature Center, 1401 Northwest Park Road, Blue Springs, Missouri. Registration is required at Missouri Department of Conservation. On 9/22 at 8 a.m. to 12 p.m., monarch tagging in Lawrence will be at the Baker Wetlands Discovery Center, 1365 North 1250 Road, Lawrence, Kansas. Once again, Monarch Watch, the Jayhawk Audubon Society, and the Baker Wetlands Discovery Center are sponsoring monarch butterfly tagging for the public. There's no charge to participants and no experience is necessary. So bring yourself, your kids, all ages, your friends, and your neighbors. If you have a net, bring that too. My name is Teresa Wilkie, reminding you these events and more can be found on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page or at the Eco Radio page on kkfi.org.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience to reflect the diversity of the local and world community and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues, and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? Contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Florence causes fears about hog waste, coal ash, and dams. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Hurricane Florence, now a tropical depression, made landfall on Friday morning in North Carolina. While its winds have slowed, the storm had dropped a lot of rain, including 30 inches near Wilmington, and forecasters were saying up to 40 inches could fall in the Carolinas before it's over.
The Cape Fear River is predicted to crest Tuesday at 62 feet in Fayetteville, more than 27 feet over flood stage. As of Sunday morning, 14 people were reported to have died in the storm.
In addition to immediate concerns about people's safety, there are ongoing worries about failures of infrastructure and water contamination.
In both North and South Carolina, about 10% of the bridges are structurally deficient. Wayne Klotz of the American Society of Civil Engineers told Newsweek that while there there are not a lot of bridges about to fall down, they weren't designed to accommodate 3 to 4 feet of rain at one time.
South Carolina has almost 180 dams, which the government defines as high hazards, meaning that if one failed, it would probably cause loss of human life and serious damage to homes and buildings. In North Carolina, there are more than 1,400 high hazard dams. Klotz said that some may have to release water to avoid breaches, but those releases could cause downstream flooding.
Floodwaters could contain toxins and contaminants. Environmental advocates have been warning that there are dozens of coal ash piles across the path of the storm.
On Sunday, an NBC News local affiliate reported that a slope of a coal ash landfill collapsed at a closed power station near Wilmington. Duke Energy officials confirmed the report, saying that enough ash to fill 180 dump trucks had spilled into a lake. But it was unknown whether that had contaminated the Cape Fear River.
In addition to those problems, industrial hog farms in North Carolina have several million tons of urine and feces in lagoons that experts worry could be flooded, spreading contents into surrounding residential areas and water supplies.
Wired reports that scientists think the state's hog farms contain antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Farmers have been spraying hog waste on fields as fertilizer, but that could be washed down into rivers and streams by heavy rains.
During the last hurricane in 2016, 14 hog lagoons flooded. Florence has been predicted to drop twice as much rain as that storm.
As Florence drenched the Carolinas, Typhoon Manghut devastated parts of the Philippines and China.
In the Philippines, Manghut, the strongest storm of the year, killed 59, most of whom died in landslides from the heavy rains. Then, after crossing the sea, it struck Hong Kong, where it swayed skyscrapers and blew out windows.
As all this occurred, a study shows that planners and developers of new cities being built around the world are doing very little to make their projects resilient to climate change.
Geography professor Sarah Mosier mapped 120 cities in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America, and was struck by how many are in vulnerable coastal areas.
She found that only 8 of the cities are even talking about climate change. Mosier said in a release from McGill University that everyone wants to live on the coast, and new cities are often geared towards the wealthy as investment vehicles.
She observed that there is no voice of reason stepping in and saying that these projects are not a good idea. As an example, she points to a new high-rise development on reclaimed land in the narrow body of water between Malaysia and Singapore. When completed, it will have housing for 700,000 people on 4 artificial islands.
When she visited the site, Mosier's guide told her that there were no worries about rising sea levels because that happens only in other countries.
Anyone who has potted plants or gardens might notice how water gets absorbed into the dirt. That happens due to the pores in the soil.
A new study from the University of California at Riverside predicts that climate change will reduce the amount of large pores that make the absorption possible, a condition that could lead to more flash flooding and soil erosion.
Macro pores in the soil are as small as 1/6 the size of a pencil eraser. The researchers found that they are less likely to develop in humid climates, and as the atmosphere warms, it's going to get more humid, meaning less macropores.
Using climate predictions for the end of this century, the scientists conclude that in most regions of the U.S., increasing humidity will reduce the large pores.
In a release from UC Riverside, the study's lead author, Daniel Hermos, said that having fewer large pores could have effects on food production, water scarcity, and biodiversity. And finally this week, want to save the planet and be healthier? Your mother was right. Eat your veggies. According to new research from the European Commission's Joint Research Center, meatless diets could cut your water footprint in half.
A water footprint is defined as the total volume of fresh water necessary to produce goods, in this case food. Raising livestock takes a lot of water, as does producing oils, sugars, and fats. But growing fruits and vegetables, on the other hand, is much more efficient.
In the most detailed study to date on consumption, researchers analyzed what people in France, Germany, and the UK eat on a daily basis and found that, on average, each person's water footprint was around 800 gallons a day. For comparison, people in the U.S. use nearly 2,400.
But the authors found that if people adhered to dietary guidelines, which generally recommend meals rich in fruit, vegetables, and grains, each individual's water footprint would fall depending on regional eating habits.
For example, a healthy pescatarian diet of fish, where animal fat is replaced with oils from crops, water consumption is reduced by a third. Following a vegetarian diet can lower an individual's footprint by 55%.
Given an upward trend in obesity, an increasing demand for meat worldwide, coupled with strained freshwater resources, climate change, and population growth, the authors see changing our diets as a win-win.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, highlighting the latest cost-effective strategies to manage aging infrastructure at the Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 28th to 31st in Atlanta. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.